Hey everyone, welcome. My name is Maryam Alamzadeh, for those of you who don't know me. And this is the first Trinity Term event on the Women's Rights in the Middle East Research Seminar. So thank you for being here. We are very, very happy to have Dr. Hiba El-Shazli with us today, who has been visiting Antonian this year, and we have loved having her around and have been really waiting for this talk. Glad it's here. Dr. El-Shazli is an associate professor of political science and a former director of undergraduate programs at George Mason University at the Schar School of Policy and Government since 2014. She teaches undergraduate and graduate courses on international relations theory, civil society and social movements, politics, governments, and society of the Middle East and North Africa, Israeli-Palestinian politics, and Islam and politics. Sure, you're in high demand these days, so we're doubly happy to have you.
Thank you.
She was awarded the 2016 Outstanding Teacher Award and the 2022 Dean Service Award. Dr. El-Shazli is an affiliate faculty to the Abu Sulaiman Center for Global Islamic Studies at George Mason University as well. And she was an adjunct faculty at Georgetown University's master's degree program at the Center for Democracy and Civil Society, I assume before 2014.
During.
Oh, we during.
Can, we
okay.
can, yeah, we can kind of be an adjunct somewhere
right.
and also
yeah.
be.
today she will be speaking with us about Tunisian trade union women, which, if I'm not mistaken, she's also been directly involved with in a former activist life.
Yes, I will tell you about that.
So,
yes.
Yeah, you are the exact person you want to hear about this from.
Thank you.
And please join me in welcoming Dr. Shah.
Thank you so very much. Thank you to Professor Alamzadeh, Maryam Jan.
Mm-hmm.
I get to practice my few words of Farsi with Maryam. And thank you to everyone here. I truly appreciate your support. And I just have to do a shout out to my dear husband. So thank you for all your support, because I couldn't be here without you. So thank you. And thank you to my school for giving me this year of sabbatical, because it's been grand, and I must say it's going to be hard to go back. But I'm looking forward to it, and registration's already open for our courses in the U.S. You know, we start early. Our courses begin, you know, on the 26th of August. So I'm teaching three. One of them is already full, and there's a waiting list. So anyway, so I better get my act together between now and then. So, okay. I'm going to talk about Tunisian trade union women. It's a bit of a mouthful, but they're agents of change. And I'm going to tell you their story and how they have been doing that within their unions, but also within their society. I think everyone knows where Tunisia is. I was there in January, but I do have quite a bit of history with them. I started working with the Tunisian labor movement in 1994. Okay, so it's been a while. And so really, this is kind of it's been a life endeavor, several decades of working with them. And seeing them today it's really very, very exciting. Okay, so first of all, why Tunisia? Okay, there's a reason, and those are sort of the three, there are three things that I want to spend time with you on today, is why Tunisia, why focusing on women and women in the labor movement, and why the labor movement also. These are all related, and I think when it comes to Tunisia, it will make sense. Why Tunisia? Tunisia had a revolution. In 2011, actually, the day 17th of December 2010 was the day that that young man, Mohamed Bouazizi, in Sidi Bouzid, set himself on fire. It was a very dramatic moment, and very sadly, he suffered, and he died on the 4th of January 2011. That moment, those days in the life of Tunisia and Tunisians led to some very dramatic events thereafter, and a revolution then ensued, an uprising. Now, Tunisia has always been, for us living in the region, for us in the neighborhood, is a quiet and gentle place. We refer to it in Arabic as Tunis al-Khadra, Tunisia the Green. It is a relatively small country when it comes, if you look at its neighbors, if you look at, you know, Algeria to one side, Libya to the other, and of course, Umm al-Dunya on the other side, Egypt, small in size and small in population. We're talking about 11 million people. So here it is in that place everything began. It's sort of where it all started. It's where that first domino fell and then the others came after. So that's why Tunisia is very important. Also, that it started all in a rural, poor area. And so you think of revolutions, you think of cities, you think of urban unrest. But this started in a rural, poor area. It was very much pointing to the crooked system, the corruption that was in the country. No hope. And a young man of 26, 27 years old, and I think you all know the story, taking his life in such a manner. Tunisia captured our imagination. It captured the headlines. It sort of stole the thunder in the region. And everyone, and I think, I know many in Egypt would say, sort of look aside and say, goodness, that's just Tunisia, you know. And they would look at it a bit with some disdain. Which is very unfortunate, but then some would say, well, then that sparked things to start happening in Egypt, you know, in January of 2011. But anyway, I just wanted to set the scene for you and why Tunisia in particular. Tunisia also has and continues to have a large middle class. And remember, that's also important, because that's that group in society that will tend to take the lead and so forth. There are a few other things that I'll point out a little bit later. Why focus on Tunisian women, of all people, if you will? Because Tunisia was also known, very much so, that it was the leader for women's rights in the region. Ever since 1956, and with their first president after independence, Habib Bourguiba was this, you know, maverick. Yeah, he was this sort of tough guy that very much advocated for women. And it took that role of emancipation of women in the Arab world. But there were some issues. There were some issues, and I will address those issues. Because when you have something coming top down, and they refer to it actually as state feminism, okay, and I think you're familiar with it, it's problematic. It ends up actually, there was a backlash, in the sense that it didn't recognize or didn't take into account some of the more conservative cultural Muslim values and traditions, if you will, in the rural areas, but also in the cities. So it was a double-edged sword, if you will. And so I think that's why it was important for me to spend time with Tunisian women in particular. Now, before I leave Bourguiba, though, he was an interesting fellow in the sense that he focused very much his policies and his agenda on education and healthcare. He said, look, this is, again, from interviews and people, you know, telling me these, and also from many readings, is that he said, look, we're a small country. We're never going to be able to compete, you know, with the Algeria or the Egypt, you know, in terms of military, if you will. So why put our money into something that we will never win, in the sense that building up their military, building up their army? So I'm going to invest in what? In our people. And education and healthcare were the best and the top. And that's excellent, really, because it left Tunisia with a healthy, educated population. And really, it factored into the middle class, in terms of building that middle class. Okay? All right. Now, why trade unions? Well, besides that, in my prior life, I spent, 28 years or so? I think so. Yes, I'm showing my age. But from 1981, 1981 with Solidarność in Poland. That's how I got roped in. I was still a senior, and I was in my fourth year at university in Washington D.C. And so I was very much attracted by the movement and this incredibly bold movement in Poland to stand up to the communist regime and so forth. So the labor movement in Tunisia was founded in 1948. Okay? If you recall, I just said that Tunisia actually got its independence in 1956. So the labor movement was actually there on its feet before Tunisia became officially independent from France. The labor movement, known as in the French acronym UGTT, which is the Union Générale des Travailleurs Tunisiens, which is the General Union of Tunisian Workers, they were founded and they were very much part of the Tunisian struggle against colonialism and against the colonial power against the French. They were hand in hand with Bourguiba and with several other leaders. And one of the gentlemen I'm going to share with you, his name is Farhat Hached. There we go. There he is. Was one of the founders, or was the main leader. And actually, very sadly, he was assassinated in 1952 by the French. So it was even before Tunisia became independent. So anyway, so I just want to point out to you that Tunisia, why it's important, why women, and then why the labor movement? Because the labor movement has been there working for independence, fighting against colonialism, and then with Bourguiba coming on board, then building a country from 1956, and they will say until today. Okay, so I've set the three pillars, if you will, and the labor movement is very much a part of it. So this is Farhat Hached. I want to show you, and this photo here, if you see, I know it's a bit grainy. Here he is with two women. We don't know who they are, but this was at a rally, and he was there with them, and you know, so it shows again, women were there from the very beginning. From 1948 until today. Then we have another one, Sharifa Msaadi. 1951, she was the first woman elected to the Executive Council of the UGTT. And please remember her because it wasn't until 2017, until the next one. Okay, no, I know, and I'll explain as to how come this distance, if you will, from 1951 with Sharifa Msaadi, who was known as a feminist revolutionary and quite the active with her husband. They were a dynamic duo, Mahmoud Msaadi. Here she is, you see her on the right in this one photo, Al-Hurriya bil-Ittihad, that means freedom with the Ittihad, with the union. With the UGTT, so that, again, freedom and the UGTT, very important. Here she is in a meeting. You can see she's surrounded, and she's standing up, and she's making a point to the gathering group there. So Sharifa Msaadi, again, very important. I mentioned to you Habib Bourguiba. Habib Bourguiba, we could spend hours talking about him, but he was very keen on setting a sort of a revolutionary women's rights law, and I must say they were, what we say, sabbain, ra'id, they were leaders in the region, absolutely. Everyone would look and point to Tunisia and say, see, look at Tunisia, because the laws were there. The problem is it was top down. Laws are wonderful, but they need to also become fabric, a part of the society. They need to become a part of the culture. They need to become a part of your everyday behavior and thinking and so on. Otherwise, it just becomes much more difficult. It becomes much more difficult. And so he wanted women to vote, he wanted women to legalize divorce, to have access to health care, and, you know, just all kinds of things that we, appreciate. So advocacy, very much. There was advocacy, change in attitudes, challenges from 1956 until the present. Now, my story with the UGTT, and particularly with the women, began in 1994. That was my first trip, September of 1994. I traveled quite a bit, and that's why I always have to say thank you to my husband, because they would always ask me, by the way, they'd say, oh, who's taking care of your children? And I would sort of indignantly say, well, my their father, you know. So it's interesting because, you know, if I was a man, I don't think I'd get asked that question, but that's another story. But I was there in September of 1994, my first time to Tunisia. By the way, we Middle Easterners, don't travel to other Arab countries very often. It's really kind of sad. We, you know, by the way, I'm originally from Egypt, so I'm putting my cards on the table here. So yes, it was the first time I'd ever been to Tunisia. It was in 1994. I met with, because I was coming representing the American labor movement, so I had quite the sort of carte visite, you know, this my business card was very important, because the Tunisian labor movement very much appreciated the American labor movement, their role, particularly during World War II and after World War II and the fight against communism, because the American labor movement, that was their very much raison d'être. That's what they were, very anti-communist and so forth. So let's say I came with very great introductions. I was with a colleague who was another woman, and we got to meet with all the leaders and so forth, who are all men. But then they arranged for a lunch, and they invited the women's committee. I remember it very clearly. We met at a restaurant called the Sharq, which, by the way, is still there. And we sat at this very long table, and the women were all on one side. I was in the middle. My colleague, Kate, was across from me, and the men were all on the other side. And conversations, you know, were happening on one side of the table, quite loud and so on. The women were rather quiet, and they would start to whisper and whisper in my ear and say, we really need some assistance. We need some help. And that was the beginning of my story, in the sense of working with them in terms of developing training programs, helping them be able to train others, and, you know, communicating and showing them various case studies and so on and so forth. And it was wonderful, because when I went in January of this year, I got to meet many of those who are now, you know, they're the ones who are teaching others, and they've been doing really a lot of great, great work. So I was very surprised, because I was coming to Tunisia with this idea that, you know, this is a country that's had, you know, such great laws and such great environment and culture for women in general in society, but also within the labor movement. And I was mistaken. I was mistaken. There's that state feminism again hitting the reality on the ground, the day-to-day. And by the way, Tunisia, and I know, Kat, you know about the national organizations, the women, Tunisian women's organizations and so forth, very active and so on and so forth. So the labor movement plays in that field where there is a vibrant civil society. Okay. We started working with them. We did a lot of work. I want to point out to 2008, just because there was a major protest in the phosphate industry, in the mines in Gafsa, which is in southern Tunisia, and the women played a very important role, even though they weren't literally in the mines, but they were protecting their husbands, their fathers, their brothers, and they were definitely protecting them against the authorities who were coming, you know, to violently put down their strike. So I just want you to remember 2008, because again, please, and I know I'm in an environment and an audience here that definitely knows that 2011 didn't just start like that, that there were many, many, many years of things boiling under the surface in all of these countries. I mean, we can go country by country in the region that could then point to, okay, we were just waiting. When was it, you know, was it going to erupt? And end of 2010, 2011 was the time. So 2008 was that point in Tunisia when they had a lot of uprisings. So we all know revolution, 2011, struggle opened a lot of opportunities and challenges. They were organizing marches and protests and so on. And they were threatened, though, by a new conservative Islamist proposal. right? And that's where we see things start to get interesting. Interesting and a bit difficult. I'm going to show you some photos, lots of photos here. This one in particular, I think you've seen it before. This was 2012. This young woman actually got a prize. She was awarded a sort of a state prize because of her courage to stand up to basically, someone with an ISIS flag. And basically telling him off. He was trying to bring down the Tunisian flag and to fly the ISIS flag. So, and then here is August 2013, Tunisian Women's Day. They organized a major, major protest. Now, why? At this time, you had Ennahda. Ennahda was the Islamist political party led by Ghannouchi, who, you know, now after 2011, political parties started to grow up, to be there on the scene. There were many, many of them, but the Islamists, of course, were the most and the best organized. And they proposed that in the deliberations for a new constitution, that they were going to change some sections in this constitution that has been ever since 1956, 59, yeah? And one of them was that women were equal or are equal to men. That was literally the second paragraph within the constitution. The Islamists had a proposal that they were going to put complement, remove equal and put complement. Now you might say, well, that's not such a big deal. No, it is a big deal. It is a big deal. And so Tunisian women, and particularly within the labor movement, they started to organize. They started to organize, and of course Women's Day was a very important day to do so, and they succeeded. They won. They won the fight. And today the Constitution still says equal. I'm going to tell you more about some of the sort of the themes from the interviews that I conducted, and particularly regarding this reopening, relitigating the Constitution, and reopening doors that had already been closed or things that had already been settled. There was no today. I mean, that's the kind of the interesting thing to come back sort of 10 years after. Or more like 13 years after, and to be able to sit down and sort of think, take a moment, take a pause, and see, gosh, what did I wish I had known, you know, 13 years ago? And what I wish we had not done, or what road we should not have gone down. And that's what I was able to do with them. I'm moving along here, 2015. The Nobel Peace Prize was actually awarded to four civil society organizations, and the UGTT was one of them because they played such an incredible role in leading the country and basically putting the politicians' feet to the fire, if you will, in terms of, literally, they were in a conference room, they closed the door, and they said, you're not leaving until there is a plan. There's a plan forward. In order for us to reach elections. And Tunisia also went about it, we all thought, us in the political science, thought, oh, they're going about it the right way, in the sense of start with the framework, start with the constitution first, and then move from that to elections. And that also gives you a period of time for political parties to organize, for people, again, to breathe a breath of fresh air. And to sort of understand what the issues were. Compared, if you look at Egypt, for example, they literally, within 1 year, they were having elections. You know, and again, this speed is not always advisable, if you will. So here we are, you know, Tunisia was sort of checking the boxes, if you will, about how to proceed with this type of transition. So that was a very important moment for the labor movement, again, in leadership with the equivalent of the Chamber of Commerce, with business, with the Human Rights League, and with the Lawyers Association. Now, you're probably wondering, okay, what about and why was it from 1951 until 2017 within the labor movement? You'd think the labor movement is this progressive force, this progressive movement. Why has it taken so long for women to have positions of leadership, even though, by the way, they represent about 55% of the membership. So you'd think, well, we can spend a few hours in the sense of, again, we are dealing with some conservative, some rural values that are difficult to change. They're difficult to change. You can't, I always say, you can't legislate behavior. You really cannot. You can encourage, but but in terms of someone's behavior and someone's thinking, you can't make a law and then they suddenly change. So the women developed a campaign, and they got a lot of assistance. Partners in struggle, partners in decision. Because we're with you in the struggle. We have been ever since, 1948. But we also want to be with you when you make decisions. And so thanks to that campaign, which, by the way, was supported by several other organizations from outside of the country as well as inside, they finally got a vote to pass a 20% quota. Let's stop here for a moment. Quotas, double-edged sword. You can have a quota and you say, okay, but you got there because of the quota, and that kind of takes away a bit of your joy. It takes a bit away of your achievement, if you will, And so some of the women were like, we've worked way too hard. Did we have to go down that road? And some would say, well, it's only temporary. It's just to get us into those positions where we could then be role models, and then we can show that we can be good, responsible leaders. And some said, whatever way it's served, we're going to take it. So today there is a quota. Now, I know there have been a lot of debates, I know in other countries, in the United States and elsewhere, is about this whole issue of a quota. And some really wish and hope that it's temporary, that it could then be removed after a certain point. But for now, it's there, and it has been implemented, and they are now at every level of the union leadership. Because unions are national, and then you have the individual union, you have leadership within, and then you have on a province level, okay, where you'll have union leadership there as well. Okay, and there's all sort of it's actually like a little government, if you look at it, sort of state, county, and municipal, as well as national. So here we are. We are now at a point where they are in these positions, okay? And I'm going to share then the stories. I think that would be best now to move on to that, because then I think it becomes more interesting. Let's see here, because I love to tell stories. So I met with agricultural workers, education. We're talking teachers and university professors. Oh, by the way, when I at the airport, I was asked, "You're a teacher?" "Yes." "University?" I said, "Yes." That was the only question I was asked by the passport control, what I did for a living. It was interesting. And also, actually, I should tell you a story. The next day, I had my first meeting was with the head of the newspaper. The UGTT has a fabulous newspaper. It's called the Shap, the People. And it is sold in the kiosks in the streets. All right. Every Friday, there's a new edition. They have a big section on football, otherwise known as soccer. They have poetry. They have news. I mean, it's really wonderful. My friend who is with me, who I've known since 1994, she was one of the ladies sitting next to me whispering in my ear, today she doesn't whisper anymore. She gets a text message from a friend of hers in the security service. She has to have friends, okay? That's the way you operate. You have to have friends. And the fellow writes to her, he says, "Do you have a guest from Jordan with you?" And she said, "No." And the nice thing is you answer them yes or no. You don't. She said, "No, because I'm not from Jordan." And then he goes, "Are you sitting in El Shab headquarters?" She's like, "Yes." And then she tells me, and I said, "Please, give him my name, give him my business card. I mean, I have nothing to hide. Tell him everything. And if he wants to meet me, no problem." I've learned this over the years that, you know, you just do that. Because they used to come to these workshops, they being security service. And, you know, they wear these black leather jackets even when it's 100 degrees outside. So, anyway, yeah, I have fond memories, you know, in Jordan in particular, you know. I just, okay. And you give them tea and coffee and you give them the packet for the materials, you know, for the workshop, everything. Anyway, so after she responded and said, you know, yes, she's this, and she's a professor, da da da. He said, "Oh, okay, thank you very much." Mm-hmm. And that was the end of it. And I didn't bother us after that. But anyway, medical and health workers, mining workers, social workers, which is very interesting because they're government employees. The geographic area was also pretty broad in terms of Beja, which is in the north, Siliana, Gafsa, which is in the south, Monastir, and Tunis. So different voices. What I did was I came up with about 9 points that came as a thread or themes, if you will, from my conversations with them. Very first one, loss of time and trust. It's like Yeritna. Why? Why did we go down that rabbit hole? In terms of relitigating, reopening the constitution. Okay, I mean, it made sense at the time. You need a new constitution. It's 2011. You know, you need to from 1959, which the days of Bourguiba. But the thing is it reopened debates on citizenship, identity, faith, women's role in society that have long been established and accepted. Now, when you're in the middle of it, of course, you're participating, you're fighting, you're so on. But now, 13 years later, you can sit down and say, what did we do? What a waste of time. And also in this relitigating, you open up wounds. You open up bad feelings and tensions and so on and so forth. So that was the first one. I would say every single one of them said the same thing. Next, a positive one, that the revolution actually opened doors of opportunity. And that included within the labor movement, in the sense that today they are organizing more workers, they are able to sort of use that as a point of departure. So, you know, sort of that's the sort of renewed interest, renewed excitement, hope. Oh my goodness, we can achieve, we can do all these great things. Absolutely, 2011 was that for them. Okay, women were now getting new leadership positions, absolutely, due to the change in the structure and the bylaws, and that's because of the quotas, okay? So again, that was a positive, and they appreciated that very much. Fourth point, confirmation that the women and leaders and rank-and-file members were involved in every minor and major protest. I mean, my goodness, they would give me lists of all the events they helped organize, the things that they were, you know, marching in, and the protests and so forth. So, you know, and they were definitely, they made their presence known. And that was confirmed over and over again. The reference to 2008, to Gafsa, was repeated several times, in the sense that, please let's not forget, this is where, you know, the initial step began that led to 2010-2011. Okay? Societal divisions, they still exist. The ladies of the salon, who are very active in the associate, Katia, you're nodding your head. You know, they're the ladies who are involved in the political organization, there's charities, the, you know, the sort of civil society and so forth. Women working in the labor movement or working and members of unions, different class. And there are some bridges, and I did talk to some women who felt that they were a bridge. And it kind of were more the profession like a doctor or a journalist or an engineer that could make that bridge, if you will. But as we know, those societal splits definitely do exist. All right. Now, even though Tunisia, now, by the way, I mean, I think you all know today, Tunisia is not in a very good spot. Okay? I mean, that's why focusing on Tunisia as being sort of this great, first, wonderful, and for several years, actually, two presidential elections and so forth. Today, Tunisia has, is it fair to say, authoritarian president?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay. All right. Yeah. And so it's sort of like, that's another reason as to why Tunisia, that I was very, for me, very important to spend some time and focus on it. So the interviewees, though, they felt, though, a stronger bond with their organization, with the UGTT. Even though the UGTT, we have to be honest and frank, their leadership were dragging their feet. They were not always. They were like, oh, you have a women's committee. That's perfectly fine, isn't it? You can stay and play your women's committee. Come on. You know? And it wasn't from 1982 when it was founded, it wasn't until 1991 that it actually became a constituent body within the organization. All right. And then 2017 is when they finally, you know, pushed for the quota. And now we actually have three members of the executive council who are women. Okay? Very competent women. And by the way, women are very keen on saying, don't look at me just because I'm a woman. I'm also very competent. Okay? So they don't want this, oh, you just got that job or that position because you're a woman. And I'll give you some examples. So anyway, but despite, you know, sort of en famille, in the family, kind of having these disgruntlements, if you will, there's still a very strong bond between leaders and within the organization itself, just because it's fighting a bigger fight. And particularly, the economic situation of Tunisia today is very difficult, as well as the political. Okay, so it's important to kind of maintain a united front. The quota system, pretty much everyone I talked to at least thought it was okay. And today, the UGTT, very sadly, is a target of the government's ire and retaliation. If you have noted, in the last 2 years, there have been arrests, imprisonments. My goodness, they even arrested a European trade union leader who came from the ETUC, the European Trade Union Confederation. We have a lot of acronyms in the labor movement. But she came to lend support, if you will, and sort of give a speech. Next day, she was told she had to leave the country. Which, actually, touch wood, is a good thing. Because, you know,
otherwise,
right? So anyway, so yeah, she packed her bags and left. So they have become now more of a target. Which, by the way, they laugh and say, we know, we've been in that position before. In the sense that they've been, you know, in that ever since during Bourguiba, during Ben Ali, and here they are today. All right, I'm going to tell you about five or six women. First is Munia. I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you last names, but just to protect them. Munia is a teacher. She's an English teacher. She started out, though, in university, because university in the 70s and the 80s was definitely a place where you became very active. Protests for justice and civil rights. So for her, it was a clear choice once she graduated to join the UGTT and continue in that struggle and activism. She's going to be retiring in 2 months, and we talked about life after retirement, so she's going to be busy. And Munia is from Beja, and she wrote a wonderful report, actually, about women's activism within the labor movement that she shared with me. Nahla works for the Union of Social Workers. She's a regional trainer. She is now an assistant secretary general of the provincial UGTT of an area called Monastir. She's a member of the Women's Committee. It's very interesting because social worker, she gets to deal with and hear a lot of stories of marginalized people and difficult situations. So she's very used to that. She's been elected now for a second term. She's single, divorced, and a mom of one daughter. And she told me some wonderful stories about what her daughter's been doing. And because, you know, daughter came with her to at all the protests. And so forth. So that's Nahla. Nejwa. Nejwa is with the doctors' union, healthcare in Tunis, the province and the city. Again, she's the one who spent quite a bit of time talking about how reopening and relitigating the constitution was such a waste of time. She did spend, though, a while talking about the apathy that has since developed. We're talking now today. Because remember, we were reminiscing. All right, but we were also talking about today. Today, either, you know, being January, February, March, April, now. of this year. People are exhausted. They're tired. They're hungry. They're unemployed. And going to protest, they're not really seeing that that's very useful. And a feeling that it really doesn't matter anymore in terms of real change. But she said she would go to the meetings of the union leadership. They would hold them and sometimes in bars. Yes, they have bars in Tunisia. Or they would hold them in cafes where... And I noticed, by the way, cafes there, mostly men. Mostly men. And she would go. She would go and make them feel very embarrassed. Share this. It's a wonderful photo. This is the UGTT's flag, by the way. Very much in the middle of things. Naziha, university professor, and she's from the town of Gafsa. I spent, I think, the most time with her. She had a lot to talk about from 2008 and the mining, phosphate mining strikes there. And she's the one who said that the very first time she had to go to a meeting, and she was so excited, she goes to this cafe. It was all men. She sits down, and the men all look at her, and it's sort of like, what are you doing here? And she said, I belong. I'm a member. And I think they were so embarrassed, again, because of the environment, the milieu, you know, that she said that the next meeting was held at the UGTT headquarters because they couldn't handle it. They couldn't handle that a woman was sitting with them at this sort of male-only venue. So anyway, she's quite the thing. This is a bit from the fabulous photo, actually. This is from the New York Times. Excellent article about the women who they basically formed a barricade to prevent the security forces from shutting down the phosphate industry. By the way, phosphate industry is a very dirty business. I mean, it infects the water. It's very polluting. It's a really, and this is an area that was very much neglected. We talked quite a bit about the dual jobs, the job at work, the job at home. And having to keep up with both, and sort of the very masculine culture that exists in Gafsa in particular, and in society. But she had a lovely statement. She said, if we feminize trade union work, we can make it more efficient and more beautiful. It just, I don't know, maybe it sounded better in Arabic, but in the sense that, you know, sort of women's participation, women's presence can make something actually more efficient because we know how to get things done, as well as make it more beautiful. I'll leave that to you. Let me know what you think. Nedia. Nedia was the last, and she's in the agricultural sector. Again, opening up a lot of opportunities to organize, to bring in these women that generally worked. These are women who do not read and write, many, actually. They work out. They have long hours. They work in the fields. They're picking olives. Olives. Very, by the way, I mean, Tunisia is one of the largest, right? Olive oil producers. Yes. But she's now, Nedia now is a member of the National Union's Executive Committee. I have some wonderful photos from her where she's going to their places of work to talk to the women, to tell them about their rights, to tell them about joining the union. Look at this truck. It's a pickup truck. Don't know if you call them pickup trucks in the UK too, yes? But that's how they would transport them. They would wait in the morning, early morning, and women would pile into these pickup trucks. Not safe. In terms of modes of travel, this is استغلال الفلاح استغلال الوسيط بدون تغطية without any coverage. They didn't have social security coverage, i.e., healthcare. They're being taken advantage of. العاملة الفلاحية, beautiful, the agricultural worker. This is olives right here, and I have other photos that show a lot of injury on her hands. Picking and working in the fields, yes. There's one here in the middle, and to recognize that this is a profession, this is a job, a work that needs to be covered and taken care of. Where is the social coverage, meaning the social protection, meaning healthcare for these women? There are. They're out. Of course, there's a lot of other agricultural pursuits in Tunisia. This is a wonderful photo. She's holding her union card. I don't know if those of you who know that when you belong to a union, you have a card. And it is a very proud thing to have when you're a member of something bigger than yourself, of a collective, where all of you together are working to improve your conditions of work. Okay, I know. This is the card up close. Okay, here we go. This is another one. These are olive trees right there. This is one of my favorites. I think you've seen this before because I used it in the 8th of March. Yes. just because, you know, that she's, you know, looking down a little bit embarrassed. This is a workshop that they had. You notice there's no paper on the desks because, you know, we're talking, we're working with them. They're telling us stories. We're telling them stories. But anyway, these are absolutely lovely. Okay, some concluding remarks, all right? Tunisia, in itself, the nature of the country, its people, its history, its aversion to violence. Actually, our colleague Michael Willis has written quite a bit about this aspect, in the sense of their attachment to legal processes, right? Very important. And it explains their success, if you will, in terms of civil resistance. And I love this quote. I've heard it too, and I know Michael's heard it as well. We had the revolution on Friday, and we went back to work on Monday. So, top-down feminist policies. This we can have a long discussion. In terms of the clash with conservative religious cultural values, the backlash, something top down versus organic coming from the bottom up, and maybe meeting the top down. So you kind of need both. But it's a long road. And it's come back to haunt, if you will, the progressive movement, particularly starting in 2011 to 2014. Women have been participating in every possible organization, but particularly in the UGTT, particularly in the labor movement. They've been doing that ever since it was founded in 1948, and they will keep participating. They're a little tired. They're a little exhausted. Maybe they need a respite. They need a rest. And we had that when we sat together. But they're ready. They're ready to go back to work. Because today, I think Tunisia, more than anything, they said this too, that they need to have an active, robust civil society. And the labor movement, 1 million members strong, is very much a part of that. It plays a political role. They're not shy from telling you that yes, they play a political role. They absolutely do. Because, you know, a lot of times unions will say, oh, no, you know, we kind of stay away from politics. Oh, no. They're in the middle, because it's very important. They got a Nobel Prize for peace, for playing a very important political role, actually. We can also argue maybe also the UGTT has been a member of international labor organizations for decades. That pressure of being members of international organizations where we talk about, you know, women's participation, whether it's at the ILO, the International Labor Organization, or the others, that's a very interesting angle to look at. You know, because a lot of times in the labor movement, we tend to be very little clubbish in the sense of, oh, if you don't fit all the criteria, you can't be a member. But maybe if they are members, we can put pressure on them, on some of these organizations. I guess we can take it case by case. But the Tunisians very much value being a part of the international community. And when the ILO comes out and says, this is the year for women labor trade union members, they want to participate. And they have to show what they have. So there's some added pressure there. And the quota, of course, while the jury's still out, many of the women said, you know, in terms of its success, the jury's still out because it's only been a few years and we shall see, but so far, positive, and let's make the best out of it. It's sort of the attitude. So thank you very much for joining me.